is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week we'll be asking, what is it that makes a good book? To judge by the response I've had, everyone's got their own ideas. So I've pulled together a batch of bookworms, both amateur and professional, to give chapter and verse on what they think. We'll be eavesdropping on an accessible book group as its members discuss The Essex Serpent.
I reckon only about one in five or one in six get fairly universal praise.
Broadcaster and literary critic Piers Plowright gives his point of view.
I love wanting to turn the pages, everybody does, but there has to be something else, an extra something other going on, you know, about the world and how we live in it.
And I join the RNIB librarians in the romantic fiction section as they get to know the books there better so they can recommend some good reads to us all.
Then there's Esme, who is a very interesting retired librarian. She's 80 years old, never been married. We find out that she's actually had a passionate love affair when she was young.
And Robert Kirkwood quizzes the book narrators for their good reads.
Quite often they're the books that aren't terribly popular or very well known, but are really imaginatively written.
That's all coming up in today's show. Last month, we talked to listener John Rigg, who set up his own accessible book group in London.
You know, these days, it seems that publishers, they coordinate the publishing of the audiobook to be, you know, roughly around the same time as the print novel, at least for a lot of the books. So one of the big differences that I've noticed is that, you know, a few years ago, when people got excited about a book, I'd have to wait a year or two. And actually, less and less, that's the case now. I think that's a big thing.
As you may remember, he invited us to join us to discuss the group's January read, The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. Described by one critic as Dickens meets Dracula, it's been a bestseller since its publication last summer and is a book group favourite. So last week I headed into Bloomsbury to hear what his circle of blind and sighted readers had to say about it.
Hi, so this is the regular monthly gathering of an extremely informal book group in Bloomsbury, comprised of people with absolutely no literary pretensions at all. And we've just finished reading Sarah Perry's The Essex Serpent. So let's pick on someone. Chris, what do you reckon? How did you get on with it?
Well, I finished it, which is always a bit of a result.
Well, you had to resort to two times regular speed.
Well, I did, which I don't really enjoy, actually, but I was getting close to the deadline. So I really liked the beginning. It was a fantastic beginning, really good use of language when that drunk guy is out on the seashore.
He thinks he sees, is certain he sees, the slow movement of something vast, hunched, grimly covered over with rough and lapping scales. Then it is gone. In the darkness he grows afraid. There's something there. He feels it, biding its time. Implacable, monstrous, born in water, always with an eye cocked in his direction. Down in the deeps it slumbered, and up it's come at last. He imagines it breasting the wave, avidly scenting the air. He is seized by dread. His heart halts with it. In the space of a moment, he's been charged, condemned, and brought to judgment. Oh, what a sinner he's been! What a black pip there is at his core! He feels ransacked, emptied of all goodness. He has nothing to bring to his defence. Out he looks to the black, black water. And there it is again, something cleaving the surface, then subsiding. Yes, all along it's been there, waiting, and at last it's found him out.
No, I really liked the book. I thought it was really descriptive, and I liked the time frame, when science was young.
Definitely one of the better books we've read. I think it was quite evocative. I think it was quite magical, really, from a literary sense, but also the way she wrote. Chris, I'm looking forward to some of your comments on the characterisations. I thought, on the whole, they were excellent. but I think there's a couple of fairly contrived bits, like Martha, for example. But overall, honestly, I thought it was a really enjoyable read, and it captivated me, and no problems, you know, turning over the pages. You know, I felt a little discontent in as much as, you know, for me, one of the things that seemed to come through this book was this whole notion around unrequited love, because it seemed to me that everyone fell in love with someone else and no one got what they wanted. And even the two people that managed to fall in love with each other, you know, at the end of the day, they couldn't even have each other. But it's a good read. Actually, Becca, you recommended it, didn't you?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I hadn't read it when I recommended it. I was hoping it was going to be a good read. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really evocative, and you could see the Essex kind of flatlands and marshlands, and you could see the mist coming up. I thought that was fantastic. I thought her characters were great, and that she writes beautifully. I really enjoyed the beginning. Nearer the end, I got kind of annoyed with it for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why. Maybe because I had to rush it to finish it, and therefore I wasn't enjoying it so much. I'm not sure. But I thought it was great. I liked the era that it was set in. I really enjoyed that. And I thought the relationship between Cora and Will was really interesting, and I kind of liked that. There were a few kind of toe curling bits, like her kind of attempt at the sex scene.
I found the sex scene really weird.
Oh, it was awful. She needn't have included that. And there were other bits. I think she almost brought in too many themes. The whole housing thing was kind of interesting, but it didn't need to be in the book. You didn't need that whole bit of social housing and trying to reform, and unless, I don't know, the guy, the small surgeon, be the imp, and then that operation that went wrong, that kind of made sense for his character, but you didn't really need to know much about the patient. But generally, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Really enjoyed it. I've got a sort of attention span of a five-year-old when it comes to reading, and so being able to just get into something and keep turning the pages is quite rare for me. I really enjoyed it. Having said that, I'm only about halfway through. I really enjoy it. I think the characters are really good. They're sort of likeable without being, you know, sort of without being unbelievable. And yeah, that sort of, I think living in London, it's great because you sort of, some of the depiction of London is really great, and having been to Essex quite a lot, it's, oh yeah, I can sort of relate to that. So I'm really looking forward to finishing it.
I reckon only about one in five or one in six probably get, you know, fairly universal praise.
We haven't heard Stephen. Stephen's not a good well, out of 10 or something.
Yeah, there's a good reason why we've not heard Stephen. Stephen?
Stephen ought not be here at all. I mean,
a lack of knowledge rarely holds you back from speaking, Stephen.
That's true. I did ask Becca to give me a little pricey so I could just opine anyway, but no, I've declined to do so.
So have you not read it at all?
Not at all.
The imp, they called him. Since he rarely came higher than the shoulders of other men and had a loping, insistent gait that made you feel he might, without any warning, take a leap onto a window ledge. It was possible to see, even through his coat, a kind of urgent power in his limbs, and his brow bulged above his eyes as if it could barely contain the range and ferocity of his intellect. He affected a long black fringe that mimicked the edge of a raven's wing. Beneath it, his eyes were dark. He was 32, a surgeon with a hungry, disobedient mind.
And we'll be returning to hear more from John and the gang later. Are you part of an accessible book group? Or maybe you'd like to set one up? I'd love to hear from you. The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk. A much-loved broadcaster and respected critic, Piers Plowright, has interviewed dozens of authors during his long and distinguished career. As a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, he likes nothing better than a story well told, be it fact or fiction. So who better to ask about what makes a good book? Thank you for joining us on Read On Air.
Delighted. I love talking about books and I love talking.
Fantastic. I first met you when you were conducting a series of interviews with authors at our local library. Did you have a favourite amongst them?
Well, I've actually interviewed something like 85 people over the last 15 years, many of whom are writers. Who sticks out? I think actually John Le Carré sticks out because he's a fantastic talker. It was the time in his life when he was just revealing exactly how much his father had influenced what he wrote, and that he himself had been, this is John Le Carré, had been a spy. So that was a kind of scoop. And secondly, he's an amazing mimic. So not just, we didn't just have John Le Carré, we had Alec Guinness in the room, practically everybody he'd ever worked with. So I think he sticks out for sort of character, and he could feel the audience absolutely lapping it up.
And as far as books are concerned, what do you think makes a good book?
Characters and story. And if I had to choose, probably characters. I love wanting to turn the pages, everybody does, but there has to be something else, an extra dimension to it. For instance, one of my greatest heroes would be Dickens, who is a writer with terrific characters. But I also love Conrad, who defeats some people, but who has some great ideas and a sense of something other going on, you know, about the world and how we live in it. So I like that sort of level. I also like comedy. I love P.G. Woodhouse. I love books that make me laugh and cheer the day up.
Do you think that there has been a golden age of literature, or maybe are we living through one now?
I think that, I mean, I don't believe in golden ages. People are always going on about them. They did when I worked for the BBC. Ah, you should have been here 5 years ago. It's all nonsense, really. It's always exciting. It's always, sometimes, it's actually quite disappointing. But I think we've got a rich seam of writing now. But if you ask me what would be my golden age, it would probably be between about 1850 and 1960, where sort of there's an extraordinary range of great classic novels in the 19th century, following through to modernist writing, some of which I like, some of which I don't, and then the comedy and the hilarity of people like Kingsley Amis, and coming through to Zadie Smith, who I'm just beginning to read and enjoy. So I'm quite wide-ranging, but I think that 100 years, 110 years, from 1850 to 1960, which is not to say that there aren't some great books coming out now.
And do you think there is still a strict line in the view of critics between what is literature and what is popular fiction?
I think we've got much, much better at destroying that ridiculous frontier. I don't think it should exist. And I remember going to see the great Egyptian Nobel Prize-winning writer Naguib Mahfouz. Last My Hero was there. And he said the purpose of literature is entertainment. High entertainment, maybe, but entertainment. And I think that's absolutely right. So we're not going to say, is this ticking all the boxes for kind of grand literature? Of course, we can see some novels stand out. But primarily, it's about being entertaining, truthful, moving, making you laugh and cry. These are the things.
And I also wonder if actually there is a trend towards the shorter book as well. I've certainly noticed that actually a lot of them are coming in under 12 hours, whereas things 4 or 5 years ago were coming in at sort of 15, 16 hours. Do you think there's a move back to the novella again?
I don't know about that. I mean, there were some very sledgehammer-type books, weren't there, about 10, 15 years ago, some of which I think were far too long. I prefer short books. But then if a book is great, you want it to go on forever. I suppose a great literary hero I haven't mentioned would be James Joyce. Now, he could do the big Ulysses-type books that went on and on and on, and he could do the wonderful short stories in Dubliners, which are a few pages each, which have everything you want. Whether there's a trend towards shorter fiction, maybe to do with people's attention span, I don't know. I can't rule on that. But I do note that the last few winners of the Booker have been fairly substantial, actually. I don't think any of them have been what I call slim volumes. So I think they go on side by side.
We have a section on Read On Air called Books of Your Life, where we ask our guests to nominate three books that have resonated with them through their lives, starting with a book that you might have read as a young man that made you wish to be involved with books for the rest of your life.
Goes to childhood with me, actually. And I've been a man who's worked in radio, so I've been a listener in the sense that I've been listening to stories told to me and then passing them on to other listeners. My first books were listening to my mother, who was a very good actress or mimic, and she read me Treasure Island when I was an evacuee in Wales with her and my sister in about 1943, Robert Louis Stevenson, and it absolutely gobsmacked me. I mean, this, the terror of it, the strength of it, the blind pew coming down the street, little Jim Hawkins in the apple barrel. This is a book that I completely grabbed me. Of course, then later I read it, and I've seen all the movies, and I used to imitate Robert Newton as Long John Silver. And I still would go back to the bookshelf. It's a book that, and I suppose it made me think, gosh, this is what stories are about. I must see if I can write some.
I held out my hand, and the horrible, soft-spoken, eyeless creature gripped it in a moment like a vice. I was so much startled that I struggled to withdraw. But the blind man pulled me close up to him with a single action of his arm.
"Now, boy," he said, "take me in to the captain."
"Sir," said I, "upon my word, I dare not."
"Oh," he sneered, "that's it. Take me in straight, or I'll break your arm."
And he gave it as he spoke a wrench that made me cry out. "Sir," said I, "it is for yourself, I mean. The captain is not what he used to be. He sits with a drawn cutlass." "Another gentleman—"
"Come now, march," interrupted he, and I never heard a voice so cruel and cold and ugly as that blind man's. It cowed me more than the pain,
and I began to obey him at once, walking straight in at the door and towards the parlour, where our sick old buccaneer was sitting, dazed with rum. The blind man clung close to me, holding me in one iron fist and leaning almost more of his weight on me than I could carry.
"Lead me straight up to him, and when I'm in view, cry out, 'Here's a friend for you, Bill.' If you don't, I'll do this."
And with that he gave me a twitch that I thought would have made me faint. Between this and that I was so utterly terrified of the blind beggar that I forgot my terror of the captain, and as I opened the parlour door, cried out the words he had ordered in a trembling voice.
Not the most positive portrayal of a blind person you will ever find in literature, but I shall make sure not to tap my stick too hard when I walk behind you next.
That's very true, Red. That's put me on the spot. I thought of Pew simply as a tremendously powerful and sinister character. The blindness, of course, is part of it. But when you're very young, you don't think about that, do you? Just think about, is this person interesting?
Absolutely. I mean, he gave me the creeps. And I mean, actually, the thing I think I took away from that was the black spot. I went around looking for black spots on people for a long time afterwards.
It's a terrifying idea that you hand on this curse, and once you've got it, you're done for. Terrific. No, I mean, the book resonates in every way, and I think the great test is that it works for you when you're grown up, just as it did when you were a child.
Which brings me on to your Rainy Day book, a book that you would love to reread given a day of indolence and nothing else to do.
Well, this is a huge book, so I need a lot of rainy days, but it's The Good Soldier Shveik by Jaroslav Hašek. It's the funniest book I've ever read. Very, very briefly, it's the story of Shveik, who is an idiot, but he's not an idiot. He's very, very clever. And he is a Czech living in the Austro-Hungarian Empire when the First World War breaks out. So he's one of those Czechs swept up into the Austro-Hungarian army. 140,000 of them died in that war. For fighting for an empire they didn't care at all about, and they didn't care. The empire didn't care about them. And Shveik is brilliantly observant, and in fact you could say it's the first big anti-war novel, which inspired, for example, Catch 22 later on. You know, that book probably couldn't have been written without Shveik, because it turns war on its head and makes the whole thing absurd. And Shveik himself, things like, "Are you a blithering idiot, Shveik?" says the commanding officer, to which Shveik replies, "Beg to report, sir, I am." And it's just a great, great character. So you're screaming with laughter, at the same time very serious points being made about corruption of the Catholic Church, corruption of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, warmongering, war itself being futile and ridiculous because it never achieves anything. It's a great, great book, and Cecil Parrott's translation available is brilliant. I'm told by Czech friends it just catches the mood of the original.
Oh, I'll have to go searching the shelves of the Talking Books Library for that. Can you recommend something else that you have read recently that you would like to pass on and share with our listeners?
Absolutely. Last summer, I was having coffee with a friend. He said, have you ever read Kent Herif, spelled H-A-R-U-F, but pronounced Herif, particularly a novel called Plainsong? I said, no, I haven't. So I got it. It's written by this chap, Kent Herif, a Colorado man, about a small town in Colorado. He's invented it, but I think it's quite closely based on a town he lived in. And it goes from the trilogy goes from the 50s through really to the Iraq War. In the lives of these people, ordinary people, farmers, keepers of pubs, inns, single ladies, people on the dole, villains, just school teachers, children, ordinary life. And it's a book that had me both weeping and laughing. You know, I don't often cry on the tube, not in public, but I did. And I recommended this to everybody I know, including my two daughters and my son. And they've all said, wow, there's something about it. It's very simple prose, incredibly simple prose. He was a great follower of Hemingway and Faulkner. He did not want kind of grandiose language. These people just speak ordinarily, but marvellously. There's a kind of, for me, a religious aura about it, though he would probably say nonsense. And I can't recommend this book enough, Plainsong. The other two in the trilogy, and I think you should read them in the right order, are Eventide and Benediction. And he then wrote other novels too, and he died about 3 years ago. Kent Herif, Plainsong, absolutely gobsmacking.
Piers Plowright, thank you very, very much for sharing the books of your life and appearing on Read On Air.
Thank you very much, Red. It's been a great pleasure. It's lovely to talk about books because they are really little worlds, aren't they? And you've been in them and you want to share these worlds with people. And I think that's the great joy.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you. And all of his choices are available in one accessible format or another. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson is available from the RNIB Library in various formats, including as Talking Book 655. The Good Soldier Schweik by Yaroslav Hasek is available as TB number 5161. And Kent Herif's Plainsong is available as a commercial audiobook. But if the number of people I've heard recommending it is anything to go by, I'm sure it'll be available on the library shelves soon.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13.
1984, by George Orwell.
It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you about when you move. Big Brother is watching you, the caption beneath it ran.
Hidden away in the record department of the sprawling Ministry of Truth, Winston Smith skillfully rewrites the past to suit the needs of the party, yet he inwardly rebels against the totalitarian world he lives in, which demands absolute obedience and controls him through the all-seeing telescreens and the watchful eye of Big Brother.
Do anything to me! You've been starving me for weeks! Finish it off and let me die! Shoot me, hang me, but not Room 101!
Every day at 2 with a repeat at 10. Or you can catch up with the whole book online at the RNIB Connect radio website.
This is Read On Air.
No matter how good a book is, it needs people to spread the word. And where better to get a good recommendation than from your local bookshop or library? Over the years, some of the best books I've read have been recommended to me by RNIB librarians, and it made me wonder just how they've become so knowledgeable. Last week, I got to find out when I joined Tracy, Andrew, Julie, Edwina, Henry, Nuala, Heather, Wendy, Joe, and Sarah for their monthly stock familiarisation meeting. This is a book group with a difference. Every month, the librarians pick a genre and each selects a title from the shelves. The book has to be available from the RNIB library in at least two accessible formats to qualify. At the next meeting, they take it in turns to present a review of their selection and give it a mark out of 10. And, as we'll hear, if they don't think it's a good book, they don't pull their punches. Fittingly for February, this month they were looking at romantic fiction.
Ah, Romance in the Library. Now that sounds like a promising title.
Hi. So I read Summer at the Lake by Erica James. I've never read an Erica James before, and she's very popular generally. The story is set in Oxford initially. There's three main characters. Floriana, who's a young, quirky tour guide, whose best friend is a male, and they've been together since childhood. And a few months before, she'd suddenly realised she was actually in love with him, told him this, and he'd put the shutters down and disappeared. Then there's Esme, who is a very interesting retired librarian. What else would they be? She's 80 years old, never been married, but, you know, we find out that she's actually had a passionate love affair when she was young with a man who was going to be a priest. So it's all very interesting. And then there's Adam. He's the male love interest. He's a property developer, but with a heart, and he's just been dumped by his long-term girlfriend. They come together because Floriana had just received an invitation to her ex-best friend's wedding. He was marrying someone else, so she'd been so distracted reading or thinking about it that she walked out into the road and got hit by a car, knocked down, and the car went off. And the other two coincidentally were at the scene and they helped her, and they all come together because of this. They go into the hospital and then they all get together and become great friends. The Summer at the Lake bit of the title doesn't actually come into it until about two-thirds of the way through, and it's the Italian lakes. And actually there's lovely, you know, it's lovely, we've got Lake whatever it is, Como I think, and there's bits of Venice as well, so it's all very, very attractive. We get the background story to Esme's life. We go back in time. We have the old back in time, and we find out what's happened. And there's twists and turns, and it was actually really, really nice. I really enjoyed it. My only main criticism would be that Adam, his character isn't very well developed at all. We know he's been dumped, but basically after that, he's just there in the background being strong and dependable and silent, which is how we all love them. So we all want to get off with him. It was delightful. More interesting than I expected. I was really enjoying it. You know from the beginning what's likely to be the outcome, but there was lots of, you know, the journey was very readable, lots of twists and turns, lovely settings, you know, things you didn't expect along the way, no bad language, no actual sex, but really lively, made me want to carry on reading it. So I would recommend it an awful lot more now, Erica James. She knew how to tell a story. She, you know, wasn't just all fluffy bits and bobs. Yeah, good one. And out of 10, I'd give it 8, actually.
Wendy now. I read Yes, Mama by Helen Forrester. I've never read any of her books before, but I had an idea that it was about Liverpool, set in Liverpool times. This book was particularly set in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And the story's to do with a child that's seeking love and its class distinctions and poverty and things like that. So Elizabeth Woodman is the mother. She gives birth at 40 years old to not her first child. She's got children already, but she has an affair with somebody that she wasn't allowed to marry because, you know, he wasn't in her class, as it were. So after she gets married to Humphrey, she has this affair with Andrew in the background, and they become indiscreet in the sense that she becomes pregnant at 40 and he panics and disappears and leaves her. And Humphrey, her husband, obviously knows that it's not his child because they're not together in that sense. The story really centres around Alicia growing up, seeking this love from her parents, not understanding why she's not getting it. Her mother employs a wet nurse for her when she's a baby, so she becomes very close to Polly, the nurse, and she actually brings her up, actually, with the other maid, Fanny. She doesn't have any friends in the local area. They're not invited to society parties anymore. And she never knows why. Every time she tries to ask her mother, she kind of bobs her off with some excuse. But she doesn't actually learn what her mother's done. until she's older. Because I listened to this on overdrive, and the romance part of this story didn't actually come in until the last hour, so it wasn't really a romance like Nuala. It came right at the end and didn't merit romance for me. I would think it was more general fiction or historical. Yeah. But it was quite well written. I did enjoy it. I think I'll take points away because I don't think it should, come under romance. I'll probably give it about 6 or 7.
Yes, Mama, by Helen Forrester. Much to her mother's annoyance, Alicia Beatrix Mary decided to be born on May the 12th, 1886, during a visit to Liverpool of the dear Queen to open the International Exhibition of Navigation, Travelling, Commerce and Manufactures. On the day of Alicia's slightly premature birth, the Queen was to drive down the boulevard from Prince's Park on her way to St. George's Hall. As a result of Alicia's arrival, her mother, Elizabeth Woodman, missed the chance of seeing her sovereign. Mrs. Dorothea Evans, the wife of a Liverpool shipping magnate, had graciously invited Elizabeth to view the procession from her bedroom window, which faced the boulevard. If you wore a veil and a large shawl and came in a carriage, no one would realise your, condition. You could watch in absolute privacy from behind the lace curtains. Elizabeth had been thrilled by an invitation from such an eminent lady, who was herself to be presented to the Queen. She had looked forward to extending her acquaintance with Mrs. Evans. She guessed that it would please Humphrey exceedingly if she were to make a friend of the wife of such an influential man, and Elizabeth knew that in the months to come she would have to do a lot to mollify an outraged Humphrey Woodman, her husband of 22 years.
Hi, it's Andrew. I read A Guide to the Birds of East Africa by Nicholas Grayson, which is a romance, but also is possibly more general fiction. Your main characters, you've got a lady called Rose, who's a Scottish ginger lady who was going to be a lawyer, went on holiday to Kenya just before she qualified and decided to stay. She fell in love with a local man, married him. He was an opposition politician, and he was kind of done away with in a mysterious accident by the government or whatever. She got the option to go back home again, and decided actually she'd rather stay and sort of train local people as tour guides. And she also leads the Tuesday morning bird walk in Nairobi. There's Mr. Malik, who goes on the bird walk, and he is very sort of shy and reserved and sort of keeps himself to himself. And he partly goes on the bird walk for relaxation and partly because he gets the chance to see Rose, because he's in love with, but he hasn't ever told her. And he's hoping to invite us to the Nairobi Punk Club Ball, which is kind of a social occasion of the social calendar, but he hasn't actually got any tickets yet, so he's kind of got his invitation ready to post as soon as he gets tickets. He's also a member of the Sardi Club, which is like a sort of gentleman's sort of social club with these various dotty people in who spend their time sort of making bets because one of them is a former lawyer, and they end up sort of, Mr. Malik kind of finds himself getting into scrapes with them because they're making these bets. And then out of nowhere, one day at the bird walk, this chap called Harry Kahn turns up, who knows Mr. Malik from school, was actually used to bully him at school. And then he turns up at the club and points out that he's actually thinking of inviting Rose to the Hunt Club Ball. And Mr. Malik said, well, you can't, because I've really invited her. Well, have you invited her? Well, I haven't actually posted the invitation yet. Well, and so the friends say, well, we ought to have a bet on this. Whoever can see the most species of birds in a week and report them back to the club will get to invite her. And so you then end up with them secretly doing this bet without sort of Rose knowing, and you get them going to various scrapes. It comes to a nice sort of twist ending and a romantic bit there, but actually the beginning and the end are the only actual romance bit. But it's quite sort of light and quirky. It's very much like Alexander McCall Smith. The narrator of the actual story in the book is kind of outside the story looking in, so you kind of get sort of like breaking the fourth wall, which is really nice. And he's got a lovely turn of phrase, and there's some bits I could quote back to you. And actually, the narrator on the talking book is brilliant for that it sounds like he's a friend telling you the story. So that's Bill Wallace, the narrator, and you get all the lovely turns of phrase and some nuances of the story. I really enjoy it. I would probably give it about 7, possibly an 8. And I, you know, I would read it again.
A Guide to the Birds of East Africa by Nicholas Drayson.
Ah, yes, said Rose Mbikwa, looking up at the large dark bird with elegant tail, soaring high above the car park of the Nairobi Museum. A black kite, which is, of course, not black, but brown. Mr. Malik smiled. How many times had he heard Rose Mbikwa say those words? Almost as many times as he had been on the Tuesday morning bird walk.
Sarah, would you like to tell us a bit about Marion Keys?
I didn't read anything about the book before I read it, but it's basically about four women, Grace, Marnie, Lola and Alicia, who are basically, it all tells their stories and their relationship with this politician called Paddy, this Irish politician, who is kind of like this charismatic, cool guy, but he's always in the papers. It starts with this woman called Lola, who has a relationship with him, and then all of a sudden she finds out that he basically is getting married in the paper through the tabloids. So she's a fashion designer, and she then decides to pack up her business all of a sudden and just move to the country because she's so distraught by what Paddy's done to her. And then it's quite a difficult read because then it sort of then jumps to someone else's story, this other woman's story, and which is Grace, who's a journalist who's basically trying to find out what happened between Paddy and Lola and try and get dig the dirt up on him. For a chick lit fiction, it was, if you read it in print, it would be like 900 pages.
Wow.
That's
an incredible... anyway, so the only romantic part, I think, is really between Grace and her other half, and then Lola, and the story of Paddy and Lola, but you don't hear much about Alicia's story too much. I mean, she's just kind of the new wife, and that's it. She's in the tabloids, but there isn't much of a story for her. And then Marnie is kind of the really depressive kind of side of the story. But, I mean, I found it quite difficult to read because it kept changing from different perspectives, and it was kind of like in third person as in first person as well. I would say an 8 out of 10. I think it's a proper chick lit, I think. I can see it being a film, being in the perspective of all these women, basically, and they're all after this, kind of like they're all after this one man.
This Charming Man by Marion Keys.
Everyone remembers where they were the day they heard that Paddy de Courcy was getting married. I was one of the first to know, what with working in a newspaper, when word came in from David Thornbury, political correspondent and tallest man in Dublin, that de Courcy was calling it a day. I was surprised. I mean, we all were. But I was extra surprised, and that was even before I heard who the lucky woman was. But I couldn't act upset. Not that anybody would have noticed. I could fall down dead in the street and people would still ask me to drive them to the station. That's what life is like when you're the healthy one of a pair of twins. Anyway, Jacinta Kinsella, boss, needed a quick piece on the engagement, so I had to put my personal feelings to one side and be a professional. Grace Gildee.
It would have been nice if you had asked me first. Alicia Thornton.
I was on the net, checking eBid for Owl Handbag by Stella McCartney, not just any owl handbag, for a client to wear to a wildlife charity thing, when I saw the headline, De Courcy to Wed. Thought it was a hoax. The media always making stuff up about faking cellulite on girls who don't have it and taking it off girls who do. When I discovered that it was true, I went into shock. Actually thought I was having a heart attack. Would have called an ambulance, but couldn't remember 999. Kept thinking 666. Number of the beast. Finola Lola Daly.
Don't you dare be happy, you bastard. That's what I thought when I heard, don't you dare be happy. Marnie Hunter.
And my thanks again to the hard-working team at the RNIB Library for making reading accessible to us all. My world would be a darker place without them. All the titles they discussed are, of course, available in various formats by visiting the RNIB Library at rniblibrary.com or calling the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 and selecting option 5.
Coming soon to RNIB Connect Radio, the book group.
I read Braille under the bedclothes. My wife hates that, by the way, because you've got to lift the duvet up to turn the page.
I do that sometimes.
Can you relate to that?
With RNIB talk and support, we listen in to a telephone book group.
When I first had my talking books from the RNIB, it was the big old, and many of you remember them, the big old players with the sort of like 8-track cassettes, like the...
I remember
huge great things they were.
Ginormous, not the least bit portable.
RNIB Talk and Support run telephone social groups for adults with sight loss. There are tele-befriending groups which help you socialise by phone for friendship and support, or you can share your passion for books and reading by taking part in a telephone book club.
Just shows how some books just endure, don't they, over decades and decades.
You know, I would take all the books that people have mentioned, you know, the Jane Eyre, The Pride and Prejudice, I would take all of them with the diary. I would take them all on my desert island. Can I have them?
No, you wouldn't be allowed to, though.
One book other than the Bible and the Shakespeare.
The book group on RNIB Connect Radio. Tuesday the 7th of March at 6 p.m. and Saturday the 11th of March at 8 a.m.
Eye health tips for winter. The cold winter months are here, which means wearing layers of clothing to shield exposed skin from the cold. But what about protection for your eyes? The cold air and windy winter conditions can dry out your eyes. Symptoms of dry eyes include a burning or itchy sensation, or the feeling that a foreign object is in your eye. Wearing polarized sunglasses when out in wintry weather will shield your eyes from drying out and also protect against UV rays from snow glare.
This is Read On Air.
Now, our discussion about what makes a good book would not be complete without hearing from some of the voices that bring them to life. Robert Kirkwood went to a rather noisy gathering of talking book narrators and asked them just that.
Talking books narrators are perhaps the keenest and most careful of readers. When they read a book out loud in studio, it's perhaps the third or the fourth time that they have experienced that text from cover to cover, working on pronunciations, tricky sentences and accents for all of the minor characters. So, at a very noisy gathering of narrators, I felt fairly confident I'd be recommended some amazing talking books when I asked them about the best one they have ever narrated.
One of the good things is that RNIB has a kind of collective memory.
Christopher Oxford.
And if you've done one in a series of books, as for example the Patrick O'Brien books, they remember that and they call you back to do them on another occasion. So I've recorded now probably 4 or 5 of the Patrick O'Brien series, and of course I'm looking forward to completing the series eventually. And you keep in your mind, in your memory bank, a store of characters that you can reanimate for each new book that you do, and that's lovely because it gives a sense of continuity. So that's one that I would remember in particular.
HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. But I put it to you, my lord, that prize money is of essential importance to the Navy. The possibility, however remote, of making a fortune by some brilliant stroke is an unparalleled spur to the diligence, the activity, and the unremitting attention of every man afloat. I am sure that the serving members of the board will support me in this, he said, glancing round the table. Several of the uniformed figures looked up, and there was a murmur of agreement.
Going back to our old days at Listening Books, where you and I worked together, we recorded the Philip Pullman, his Dark Materials trilogy, which I remember with particular pleasure because there were so many different characters and it was so well written by a teacher who'd often had to tell these stories to kids that I found that a very positive and rewarding experience as a performer, interpreting all the different characters.
Christopher Oxford was reading HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. It's 14 hours, 7 minutes long, and the catalogue number is 14315. Next up, Stephanie Beattie.
One of them for me has to be my favourite of all time is Gillespie and I. I just love it. It's set in Glasgow at the time of the Great Exhibition of 1888. It's a thriller. It's got tremendous twists in it. It's hilariously funny. There's a particular scene set in Hampstead Pond with somebody swimming. I will say no more than that because I don't want to give anything away, but it is a scream. And it's a huge tome. It's not one that you can easily read in bed, but you can easily listen to it and lose yourself in it. That's got to be it.
Fresh air was what I craved. Fresh air and distraction. To escape the odour of hothouse funeral flowers and to purge my mind of bad memories. As you may remember, the first Glasgow International Exhibition was staged in the year 88. For several months, the newspapers had talked of little else, and it occurred to me that some solace might be found in a sojourn to the magnificent spectacle that was said to bestraddle both banks of the River Kelvin. Thus, in the second week of May, having closed up my aunt's little house in Clerkenwell, I took the train to Scotland.
Gillespie and I by Jane Harris, read by Stephanie Beattie, lasts 17 hours and 50 minutes. It's talking book number 18842. Now, visually impaired narrator Giles Abbott tells me about his favourite, a well-self book called The Butt, An Exit Strategy.
There were places in which the writing was breathtaking. There were also incredibly long, multi-clausal sentences and some very long made-up names. And he's living in a world whereby smoking is now a capital offence, smoking in public or something like that, I forget. His life is turned upside down. He ends up in this very strange... There's a strange traditional society where he's staying, which is kind of Australia and kind of Iraq and kind of all sorts of places. And it's all about how do you accommodate for different cultural practices and how much do you and how much should you. And it's wonderfully weird. And yeah, his life is turned horribly upside down. More characters than you could shake a stick at. So, you know, I'd prepared, I'd read, but every time I came to a new character, I just thought, okay, here goes. And just sort of did something different with my vocal anatomy. I'm also a trained voice teacher. So I can pull various stunts with the old pipes, you know what I mean? And so it was a fun challenge. It was the first one, so I guess that sticks in the mind.
The whole garish infrastructure of this public health campaign appeared, even to Tom's indolent ethical eye, to have been imposed on the country's polyglot and heavy puffing population, in place of any more commanding civic morality. And so it all had grated on Tom, turning those little interludes of cloudy self-absorption into hurried and unsatisfying liaison with La Divina Nicotina. Yes, giving up would free him from such bondages, while, at the same time, he would find liberation in doing the right thing, facing up to his mortality, his responsibilities as a father, a husband, and a citizen. No longer would he sustain his individualism with such puerile puffing.
Giles Abbott was reading The Butt, An Exit Strategy by Will Self. It lasts 12 hours, 6 minutes, and it's catalogue number 16236, and it contains language that might be considered offensive. Now, Christopher Ragland tells me about a few books that have stuck in his mind.
I've done a few biographies, which were quite cool. There was a biography of Dave Grohl, who's the lead singer for Foo Fighters, and that was a really interesting, especially for anybody who likes music, because he has such a love for music, which is fantastic. There's a long one called Matterhorn, which is about the Vietnam War, a kind of semi-autobiographical account with that, but a fictional story, and that's fantastic. And 127 hours, if anybody wants to read about a guy having their arm almost... Oh, no, actually, eventually torn off after a while. So all of those were quite fun to quite get into.
I know in 127 hours it's hard to read, it's hard to watch in the film. How was it to narrate?
Hard as well. I mean, especially when you got to the point where he's doing the things that he's having to do to himself. And it's a bit... I would say the hardest part about that book, actually, is he really describes... He makes a video at one point to his parents, and having to try and get yourself in the position where you're making that video for your parents, saying, "I'm going to be dead when you find this." That was quite intense. And then when he described cutting through his arm, which as you do on a normal day. But yeah, it was all quite cool.
On Sunday, April 27th, 2003, 27-year-old Aaron Ralston set off for a day's hiking in the Utah Canyons. Dressed in a t-shirt and shorts, Ralston, a seasoned climber, figured he'd hike for a few hours and then head off to work. 40 miles from the nearest paved road, he found himself on top of an 800-pound boulder. As he slid down and off of the boulder, it shifted, trapping his right hand against the canyon wall. No one knew where he was. He had little water, he wasn't dressed correctly, and the boulder wasn't going anywhere. He remained trapped for 5 days in the canyon. This is the account of those 5 days, of the years that led up to them, and where he goes from here. This book contains language and passages of a disturbing nature that might be considered offensive.
It really, really does. 127 hours between a rock and a hard place by Aaron Ralston is 12 hours 35 minutes long, and it's talking book number 18599. Now, sometimes narrators are introduced to new genres that they normally wouldn't read. Here's Eric Myers.
Philip K. Dick, his series of short stories. I had a joy doing those. And I never realized that I was somebody who might be interested in elements of science fiction, and his writing I found very refreshing and, you know, unique. So I was more interested in clever and psychological pieces of science fiction after that. So reading that, and I'm glad it was suggested to me.
And sometimes narrators have simply done too many books to recommend a favourite. Here's Hayward Morse.
There are several I do, although you may not realize it by the way I speak naturally, but I spent a lot of time living in North America, so I've done mainly American books for the RNIB, and some of them have been terribly interesting. Usually, it's very interesting when you get to know books, and books that sell and books that don't sell. And quite often they're the books that aren't terribly popular or very well known, but are really imaginatively written and perhaps a bit surreal and quite unusual, and yet they're not bestsellers or popular in that way. I think, if anything, that's what I've usually found about the books that have interested me. They're not the big bestsellers in the commercial sense, you know. They're like discoveries, which is always nice for me.
My favourite book, you asked what my favourite book is.
John Chancer.
That's very difficult to say. I think the last count is I must have recorded about 430 books in the last 30-odd years, and I would say that it would be impossible for me to say which one would be the most favourite one. I can't tell you that, but thank you, and I hope your listeners will carry on enjoy reading all our lovely books at the RNIB.
Thanks to all of the narrators of RNIB Talking Books. For more information on the Talking Book service and to request specific books, you can head to www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Thanks for that, Robert, and to the narrators for some great recommendations. Now, let's return to that Bloomsbury Pizzeria. where John Rigg and his book group are still digesting The Essex Serpent and are about to reveal that it's not just the writing that determines how good a book is.
That's true. I think she maybe should have died and they still didn't get together. I think that would have been...
Oh. You love this sort of stuff.
But it's just too neat otherwise.
Yeah. How much does the narrator affect the way you enjoy a book?
Massively. Absolutely massively. Chris, listen, I know your views on this are, I mean, you know, very strong. I mean, you often refuse to listen to a book if it's anything than an excellent narrator.
Yeah.
Was I if it's half decent narrator, I would still struggle. I would soldier on.
Yeah. I think when you get a really, really, really good narrator, you just like, you realise that it's doubling your enjoyment of the book. As John says, when I get a bad one, I just like, I can't finish it.
To be honest, in my opinion, Chris, I don't know what you think, but in my view, most of the narrators on the, you know, I tend to listen to most of my stuff on Audible these days. Most of the narrators, and I think, are excellent.
They
really are very, very, very good. If they get the author to read, then, you know, it seems, oh, you know, this is a genuine interpretation of the written word, and it's a wonderful thing. In my experience, almost invariably, that's a, you know, for me, I don't know, I know I'm about to cringe when I start listening, because it's quite a different skill to be able to be a good reader, you know, compared to a good author. And honestly, I mean, most of the books that I've read or listened to that have been read by the author, I just think are really, I mean, it's just embarrassing.
I think you've been a bit harsh, because I think there's like John le Carré, I think, is brilliant at reading his own books. Stephen Fry's obviously brilliant at reading his own books.
I think you're picking the exception.
No, but then the Poisonwood Bible, coming back.
Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah, she's
Kingsolver.
She's excellent, I thought.
Okay, so I'm going to have to then compile evidence and present.
Yeah, I think statistically you're probably in the majority, yeah.
I listened to, that when we did My Brilliant Friend, I did that one as audiobooks and hated it. On the radio, they've just done it last week or the week before as a, you know, abridged version in something, books on Radio 4, and it was an English narrator, whereas the version I listened to was American and I hated it, and it just sounded so much better.
In as much as this comprises of a substantive element of our discussion, you've heard it.
Well, I hope I can come back, because that was great. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yeah, as you can tell, it's...
Come back.
Yeah, do come back. As you can tell, we don't tend to steer towards the intellectual, but if you can handle that, you're very welcome.
My thanks again to John and the gang for letting me eavesdrop on their book group. The Essex Serpent is available commercially and is currently in production at the R&IB Talking Books Studios. After hearing so many good things about it, I can't wait. So that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and interviewees, and to everyone who's been in touch about their book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read up on. If you'd like to get in touch about anything you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. That address again is readonair@rnib.org.uk. Until next week, thanks again for listening, and remember to read on.